The following interview was recorded in the KGVM studios on May 16th, 2024. Hello, you are tuned to KGVM Bozeman, Gallatin Valley Community Radio. We're at 95.9 on your FM dial, kgvm.org online. And I'm here today in the KGVM studios with a couple of concerned citizens from Bozeman. I wondered if you guys would want to just introduce yourself.
Yes, hello. Thanks for having us. My name's Noah Tenbrook, and I live down on North 5th Avenue.
Hi there. My name is Emily Talego, and I live at the intersection of 5th and Short Street.
All right. And so I think that the topic for today is, at least initially, to talk a little bit about a topic that's, I think, on a lot of people's minds here in Bozeman at this point in time in particular, about kind of the growth of Bozeman and the effect that that has on housing supply, and specifically on affordable housing supply. And I think the place that we started, that, like, I know, Emily, you've been kind of involved in a lot of different aspects of things with city policy and the way that it affects citizens for quite a while. But I don't know, Noah, you kind of got involved maybe more recently, and this is kind of specifically around the question of the application to build high-rise apartments. I think it's called the Guthrie. The project's called the Guthrie, and it's kind of right off in North 7th.
Correct.
Yeah. Correct. Yeah. This is really my first real meaningful effort in grassroots engagement with the city in general.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so this sprang out of this application to build this complex. I wonder if you guys could kind of describe what the project is as it's been proposed.
Sure, yeah. So the application came in, and the zoning on it is an R5, but there's a couple different layers going on here. It is redevelopment of what was the Gallatin Senior Center, and so that was a basically like a retirement home within our community. Housed, I can't remember how many residents.
About 45, 50.
And then there was staff there. But yeah, it's been vacant for a bit. It was purchased by the developers. And what is being proposed there. So right now it was constructed in the 50s, mid-century kind of architecture on it, two stories. And yeah, and it's got these two wings on it that are kind of like the residential wings. But it's a redevelopment proposal, and it is proposed at this point a five-story, and it is proposing to take advantage of the Affordable Housing Ordinance deep incentives. So a lot of it, the tension that we've, experienced in the kind of downtown core and adjacent to that midtown, all these places that are experiencing a lot of redevelopment, which is, it's different than greenfield development. Greenfield development, there's nothing there to begin with, and it's a blank canvas. Redevelopment is fundamentally changing what is there for something different. Sometimes adaptive reuse happens, but it is located within the Neighborhood Conservation Overlay District, which has some special constraints in that. And it is outside of the Urban Renewal District, so it's also not eligible for, things like some of the relaxations that are happening in the B2M District. So 111 units, and average square foot on that, I think, was somewhere around like 340 some square feet.
Yeah, it ranges from 311 to 550, I believe, something like that.
Yeah. It was difficult because the application materials, as they were submitted, depending on which document you looked at, whether it was, the pro forma for the adaptive reuse, whether it was the cover page with the project narrative, whether you were looking at the actual engineering, the site plan documents, had different numbers for what the square footage would be. So the application did go back, and so we'll see it when it comes back again to see what those numbers look like. But considerably different use than was there previously.
Yeah, it's not an adaptive reuse at all. It's a tear down and reconstruction of something that completely misses the mark of fitting in the neighborhood. And so if we had an HOA, which we don't, we have a NCOD, which is a Neighborhood Conservation Overlay District, which has pretty good guidelines as far as like if something were to be remodeled or rebuilt or reused, that it would look and that it would toe specific lines of character and culture that's embedded within the community. And that is also part of the relaxation to some degree that is being proffered by the city in exchange for quote unquote affordability. So for the deep incentives for the affordability, there's a variance on height, two extra stories. They're only using one. There is a relaxation on parking. So for 111 units, you'd have 111 spaces generally on site, and I believe they have 30. And the character, obviously, and the building materials. So there's a deviation there as well. Those are massive departures from anything that would resemble what the culture, what the flow, what the community feel is like in our neighborhood.
Yeah, and that's, you know, a lot of the, so our neighborhood is eligible to be, you know, registered as a historic district. There's some maybe differing opinions about interpreting the section of our code that talks about the historic districts. But what we do know is that, you know, our block that we live in is an R3. It's residential. And so it isn't a mixed use. It's none of those things. And so we've all been slowly working on our homes. A lot of us bought in that area because it was affordable at the time when it was bought, and slowly making improvements. And what we've been bound to as far as, you know, these kind of design standards, it's not, I personally don't feel like it was anything really, you know, no one was telling me like you have to have a certain color door. And it's not like being in on South Wilson, right, where it's like, you know, it's not Victorian, but it's very much like sympathetic things. And so we've actually seen some really cool, you know, additions put on in our neighborhood. But yeah, open concept fencing. But yeah, everyone who's done stuff there has been held to this standard. And I think it becomes sort of like the de facto covenants, sort of, mm-hmm. You know, that because you're an older neighborhood that maybe didn't have design covenants associated, that's what it's been relied on for a long time. So when you make this major investment in your life, that's like, well, I'm purchasing in a neighborhood conservation overlay district. I'm not purchasing in a commercial, or I'm not purchasing in a B2M, which is one of the commercials. So yeah, so that's that element of predictability that is mm-hmm. that is built into that. You know, so we could talk about that more, but I think the major things going on here, it's not so much what it looks like. I mean, that's it is a piece of it.
Right.
But things do change, right? that happens.
Yeah.
I think, at least for me, it's, it's an issue of function. It's an issue of interpreting and applying codes equitably within residential districts. And then there's the big issue, the affordability.
Right.
And the deliverable of that.
The community benefit, so to speak, in exchange for the variances and the incentives, right? So
I've looked at this some, but not maybe in quite enough detail. And, you know, this discussion kind of is playing out all over the city, really, in different places and in different ways. But my impression, and I know this is different from some of the other proposals, you know, it's like I just saw one this week, I think, for another big apartment complex, and they were talking about putting in, I think, 11 units that met the affordability criteria, and that would allow them to take advantage of the deep incentives. And it's like, you know, that has a certain smell to it that I didn't find particularly appealing. My guess is, and without having, I don't remember quite what I read about the Guthrie, but since all of the units seem to be so small, I'm guessing that maybe this is not one of the ones that's proposing to be quite so much. I kind of hesitate to use this term because I think it gets used and abused a little bit, but luxury condos or luxury apartments. It seems like with the size of them, maybe not so much of that with this particular proposed construction, but certainly a lot of people packed into this thing. And, you know, I've seen a fair amount of discussion about the affordability of it. And I guess I have some questions about that. Like, I see people berating the city, and my initial reaction, they would be complaining because of the city's definition of affordable didn't seem reasonable. And I'm like, as I understand it, it's not the city's definition of affordable. It's the Housing and Urban Development's definition of affordable. And maybe you might not agree with that, but you know, it is what it is. So I think there's 80% and 120% of area median income for different categories of affordability, I guess. And it wasn't clear to me, I guess, if they are claiming that this is going to satisfy affordability constraints, I would guess that it must be within, at least within 120% of AMI for proposed monthly rents, or, you know, whatever their formula is. And I know I have a hard time disagreeing with people talking about that's not really affordable. And I'm like, I don't disagree, but I'm not quite sure what definition of affordable people would like to use. And so I get this feeling sometimes that maybe what people want and what can happen are not compatible with each other. And so I'm kind of curious to, like, maybe we'll dig in on the affordability component of this, because I understand the character, and this is another thing that gets talked about a lot. And I think in my mind, this is between 5th and 6th, and kind of that street, like the next one south of where the Elm is. And it's kind of, there's a motel on South 7th.
On Sapphire, it would be in the backside.
It's behind the Sapphire,
right.
Off of Villard. Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's in this kind of, it's in this place where it's like kind of right at the edge of the residential neighborhood, I would guess.
Down that street is still residential.
Yeah. On the other side of it.
On both sides of it.
On 6th, too. It's worth, their traffic study completely failed to point out sixth is there.
Exist on the traffic.
Here's engineers, here's the bus, you know. So So the affordability part of it, and, you know, we have to talk about the ordinance,
right,
and how that came to be. I mean, so in 2022, in the summer, when that came before the Community Development Board, they said no.
Right? The deep incentives,
that is. The deep incentives. Mm-hmm. You know, at that point there was very, very little. I mean, there was just a handful of public comments cumulatively with all outreach.
Almost 8, I believe.
Something, yeah. But the reason that they pushed forward with it, and I think the reason, in my opinion, why it happened so fast, was it was a response to the state legislature eliminating inclusionary zoning.
Right.
And so when they were looking at that, the pro formas and things that the consultants were working with was really for townhouses. That's how that would pencil out, right? Mm-hmm. It was never discussed about doing it for the scale of like this kind of and it was also meant to be paired with things like a LIHTC, so low-income housing tax credit projects, to give them some wiggle room, you know what I mean? Because some of those little relaxations, depending on the site, instead of them having to go through what was the PUD, but is now the PDZ process, right? Yeah. There's so many acronyms. But to streamline that for them in order to get some of these affordable projects out of the ground.
Somewhere.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, is, you know, when they were looking at affordable, they were still looking at like a 60%. So the 120 is for ownership.
Okay.
So that is still, I mean, that's still short of what's going on. But it was a different, there was different economics at play in 2022.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so when you fast forward to now, I mean, as the ordinance is written, yes, it says you use the HUD metrics, but it also does say in there that, like, administratively, you can adjust those metrics, right? Like, mm-hmm, that tool is written in there, at least, you know, that was the dialogue. So it hasn't been deployed yet, right? And so, like, these very preliminary precedent-setting interpretations are going to be really, really important because, you know, you're saying it doesn't seem like a luxury type of deal. It's like, it, and it's not, I mean, it has the same kind of shell, if you will. Like as far as the form goes, these big blocks that we're seeing go in the downtown core, but just less high end, lower end finish, you know, finishes and siding and things like that. But the strange thing about the AMI calculation, the tragic thing, is that as proposed, it matches market rate for some of the luxury apartments in town right now, like in the Cannery and stuff.
Really?
Really. Really.
Well, okay, that's a pretty significant miss, I guess.
Then. Yeah, and so...
I mean, I think one of the issues is there's a lack of plasticity, a lack of a real dynamic way of capturing real wages and a real need, and being able to adjust that on a 6 month to on a year to year basis, where you're like, what's affordable now, right? So you're setting this 80% AMI metric in COVID when everything's just going nuts, and then there's really no language built into the ordinance that essentially creates plasticity on a scheduled basis. Right. And so you end up in this mess where it's like, it's a misnomer. Obviously, everybody's upset because the term, the word, the semantics of affordable are mismatched with what we are taught and with what we understand. Right. So you just call it something else. But we can't call it affordable.
Our neighborhood did meet with the developer.
Yeah, and Andy Holleran said, let's get rid of affordable.
Well, yeah, because I was like, call it whatever you want, you know. But I think that's a problem with the city. That's a policy problem. Like, when you tell me something's going to be affordable housing, right, like, don't just stop, because that is creating tension and disappointment, because the project cannot deliver on what we all understand to be affordable, right?
Right.
Like, and just, you know, just some like kind of stats 101 stuff, right? Like your populations, right? So when you're sampling this, renters in Gallatin County, right? Like the numbers that they're using typically make about 50%. So if you're calculating the affordability metric or the AMI for... a group that is going to affordably live somewhere, you should probably use the renters for the people who are renting.
Yeah. So. Maybe not do a across the board metric for people that are buying homes to gauge that for that particular situation, which is very
especially
different.
Once in Big Sky, right? It's incorporating
countywide
incomes of homeowners in Big Sky. And so it's like, hey, right, like that's
there might be some biases there that
or the numbers are going to be skewed big time, and so because of that you're going to miss your mark entirely.
But wait, it was never supposed to be affordable for one person, remember that, right? It was like Andy Holleran specifically said two people could live in this 311 square foot unit and share the cost of rent. And it's like, it would come under $1,000, you know, the rent would be $1,000 or less than $1,000 each.
Yeah.
But
fine, right?
But $1,000 a bedroom is the going rate, right?
Right.
Of course.
Most of these are kind of studio or one bedroom, right?
Most of them are studio.
Yeah.
That's what I say. In one of the pro formas they did for, you know, that they had to try and provide to show that adaptive reuse wouldn't pencil out, they did refer to them as studios. So... it's my understanding too, is that, you know, when you look at the ordinance where it's like, wait, what, how is this going to be? So there's the concern I have is the enforcement of this sort of thing. So, because the lift would be later, right? The big lift for the, maybe it wouldn't be the developer at that point, unless the developer decided to keep the project.
Right. Which seems pretty unlikely to me.
It's uncommon. It's particularly with this developer.
Yeah.
That, the reporting that would be required would be, okay, at this point in time, this was the AMI, and this person, here's all their pay stubs or whatever, and so this was in compliance. They have said that they were going to do some of them. We did ask them, could you not do 30-day leases? And they said that they, you know, may consider not doing 30-day leases for some of the units. But when I think about that, I'm like, reporting... on a 30-day current, how what does this look like? Would we have the capacity to even check? What kind of staff time would be required to, in a meaningful way, say, oh, okay, this is complying. This is complying.
Yeah, the amount of paperwork and administrative time to process that doesn't seem like it would be practical on a 30-day basis.
I mean, if somebody tells me that it is and this is how we'll do it, great. That's awesome. Right. You know, I'm hoping it's just a blind spot for me.
Artificial intelligence.
that's the
there's something artificial going on. That's for sure. But
yeah. So there's a part of me that worries that maybe it's actually not possible to build something that would meet a reasonable expectation of affordability and meet a reasonable expectation of fitting in, depending on where you were going to do a project like this. And because of the cost of development stuff, you know, can it be done? And if the answer is no, then I think it's a pretty difficult exercise to try to decide where do you want to go from there. I personally am, you know, I try to keep up on a lot of the discussion about this. And I think that, you know, I see a lot of things I think a lot of people have this idea that if we didn't, and this is more so the luxury condos and stuff, right? If we didn't let those be developed, it would be better. And I'm reasonably sure that I don't think that that might be true, because I think all of the people that would buy those things, they're not going to just go away. So the alternative is, instead of buying one of those, they're going to go buy a house on a lot and scrape it and do something different. Or maybe they'll buy two houses and scrape them and build one. Or they'll go out into the county, and instead of being in a condo stacked up, they'll have 5 or 10 acres. And then, you know, if we're talking about being concerned about water use, which is a topic that comes up a lot, there's no way that's better for the area. So it's trying to figure out what's the least bad, I think, is kind of this place that we're at. It's like, well, these things aren't good. I wouldn't dispute that with anyone. I don't like what's going on either. But trying to decide or be realistic about what the options are and what other things could happen. And I think it makes having the discussion so hard, because, you know, you can't look at something like this and say, sure, yeah, obviously this fits in the character of the neighborhood. Well, no, obviously it does not. And so I think you said earlier, kind of then the question is, does the benefit to the neighborhood or the community at large, maybe to the detriment of the neighborhood, justify making those concessions? And I think that's where things get really complicated, to try to see. And, you know, that's the place I think I always kind of end up in. It's like, okay, what do we do instead? And, you know, what are some options? And, you know, if are some of those options actually capable of producing reasonable amounts of housing that real people here can afford? And, you know, if the answer is no, that's, I don't know. We're in deep trouble. But
I think that's a great question. And I believe I kind of look at a city as like an ecosystem where everything belongs. Like everybody, every demographic, everybody should have a sense of belonging. And I also believe that as cities grow, they become more complex, more sophisticated. Yeah. Right. And I think that's what we're missing right now in Bozeman, is we're missing a lack of sophistication that should be concurrent with some of these massive developments that are $50, $60, $80, $100 million, right? These are developments that you would see in downtowns of major metropolitan cities, where you have heavy hitters in commissions and heavy hitters on boards that have a lot of intricate networks within the city and within the community to help guide us away from unintended consequences, etc. Right. I think it's very interesting that, like, when you need a new fire department, we go and build it. It's beautiful. Yeah. You need a new school, we go and build it. It's beautiful. But when you need to put some veterans or some police officers or some teachers in a house, we don't have the land and we can't build it. I mean, what's the difference? A structure is a structure. Yeah. Right? And it's sort of this idea of, like, we need to figure out who the vulnerable people are in the community that are being pushed to the outskirts or pushed out of the community and jeopardizing the integrity and the cohesiveness of the community. And we need to create public owned housing for them. And that is something that you'll see in every sophisticated society around the world. It's something that exists in the United States, and it's something that can exist here. We have those tools.
I think it would be really interesting to me to understand the history of how maybe some of that came about in other places, bigger urban areas. And I guess I wouldn't be surprised if the discussions that they had in those areas that led up to the creation of that might be fairly similar to the discussion that's going on here. You know, it maybe that's not true, but I kind of suspect that this is not a new issue. You know, people, sometimes I see people talking about it here and it's like, oh, it's, they seem to sort of have this idea that this is a unique problem to hear. I'm like, have you never been to a big, Chicago didn't just spring up that size, right? It grew from a small place to a bigger place to a bigger place. And I'm sure the growing pains as it went along probably were similar. I think it's probably a little different now. Maybe this isn't true, but I suspect that the way that wealth has accumulated and the effect that that's having on this particular moment in time, and specifically on the development and acquisition of an investment in housing here, I wonder if maybe this is kind of unique. This point in time might be different from previous points in time. But then, you know, if I think back to, you know, the Rockefeller era and stuff, it's like, maybe not. Maybe this really isn't that different from what went down then too. But if it is similar, maybe we should be digging through our history books and trying to figure out, maybe we could short circuit some of the ramming our heads into the wall, trying to figure out what's the path that will actually get us there and, you know, skip a few steps. I think that is an interesting observation about the fact that there are certain kinds of things that we can build. And we might quibble a little over the cost, but at some point we as a community, finally all enough of us get together and acknowledge that we have to do it. And so we're just going to do it. And this thing, for some reason, maybe that could happen eventually. I suspect that it would take longer and be a lot more difficult. And the why of that is puzzling, I guess. I mean, I think we, you know, especially because we're in the West or in the United States and we still cling to this rugged individualist myth.
Well, but P.S., we all use public infrastructure to get here today.
Exactly. Right? You know, it's like we have this weird short-sighted blind spot about how we as individuals don't take advantage of the public largesse, and we can do everything on our own. And I think for odd reasons that in particular, when you start talking about housing for people, that kind of swamps a lot of other considerations, it seems like, you know, and people, they don't want to seriously discuss the idea that, you know, maybe it's time that we admit that it's not a bad thing if we just help provide housing, especially, like you said, it doesn't seem to me like it should be nearly as much of a task to convince people of this, whether it's right or wrong. But if you're talking about housing teachers and police officers and firemen and, you know, people that are maintaining our, you know, our quality of life here, and, you know, there's everybody's maintaining our quality of life, but those are things that are easy for people to connect the dots and say, oh yeah, I need that function in my life, to not be able to go, oh yeah, you know, it's not really that significantly different housing the people that are going to work at the firehouse from housing the fire trucks. But we have a hard time, I think, connecting those dots. And I wish that weren't true, but I think because of that, it's, you know, those discussions, I think, are monumental tasks to try to get people over that hump. And, you know, so in the meantime, prices just keep going crazy. And, you know, what are some things that can happen to in some way mitigate?
Well, one of those things is like what you did with the condo, right? I mean, that's exceptional. And I mean, that, what was it? The affordable housing project, the Arrow Leaf. I mean, that was philanthropy too, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, if we have community members with capacity to help in that regard, no one might know this number better than me, but when we had the affordable housing ballot initiative, what was that, the fund There was, do you remember how many people?
I don't know.
It was a high percentage of people who were in favor of funding it.
In the mid-40s, I would say. So there was a mid, you know, we were close to that threshold of 51% or whatever it is to get everyone involved in paying a little bit extra on their property taxes to create a fund to support affordable housing.
Right.
And it didn't pass.
I'm pretty sure I voted for that, but I think one of the things that was probably, I mean, the rugged individualism thing probably was the thing that nuked it mostly, but I kind of got the feeling that I didn't understand for sure how that fund would actually be deployed to. I did hear some things about it, and they made sense. And I'm not personally one that needs all of those details. I'm okay to kind of leave it on, take it as a leap of faith that if we make this available, somebody smart will figure out what to do about it. If they don't, we can go back and we can demand that they do better. And, you know, sometimes that works, sometimes that doesn't. But I don't prescribe to the notion that we should just not do anything until we can see it all the way through, because then you never do anything. But yeah, I think that was part of the problem, was that people weren't quite sure how it would help. And,
right.
You know, it's unfortunate. I think that, you know, I saw some presentations from the city that talked about things, and they had some actual concrete examples. And it's like, you know, it wasn't a big slam dunk. We just solved, you know, a problem for a huge number of people in one fell swoop. But it, you know, it was kind of chipping away at the problem in different places and actually making measurable progress. And it's I think that it was unfortunate that maybe that message didn't get out there or didn't penetrate when it did.
What's insult to injury about it is the lack of, again, sophistication or creativity. Is we have 43, let's call it 43. I don't know what the number was of the percentage of people that agreed to wanting to raise their property taxes to support this fund. We have 43% of Bozeman that's willing to take money out of their pocket and put it towards something good, something meaningful. And it's sitting there, unharvestable.
Right.
And I was saying, this is where creativity and sophistication come in. On that tax bill, put a voluntary box that you can check that says, look, if you're in favor of any of these initiatives, whether it's something that's super Republican or something that's super Democrat or something controversial, like, we still believe that these things need funding. Mm-hmm. Check that box, and that money will go and be designated towards that cause. Now, maybe you won't, you know, get everybody in the 40% range, because some people are like, well, I'm not paying it if Sue isn't paying it or whatever.
Right, right, yeah.
But I dare say you could get 50% of those people to say, you know what, like, what's $20 to me?
Right. I would.
Right. And we're just leaving that on the table year after year after year. And it's just like, it's little things like that that make all the difference. It's all about organic growth. Anything right. that's massive, like the Guthrie, that's massive, like the North Third Apartments, like, I understand the impact they're trying to have, but the unintended consequences are going to be as large as the impact they're trying to create. It's an order of magnitude. You make a small development, small impacts, large development, large impacts. Large development should go through many more safeguards than small. Right. And they generally do. But I think they even need more. Like, Guthrie's is a great show for that.
Well, in particular, redevelopment, right? I mean, because we could, I won't get us into the weeds with, like, form versus use based, you know, but zoning. But for all intents, the form of the adjacent part of the city, the streets, the school, the, you know, it's there already.
Right.
And so unless you're doing whole quadrants of town where you are, you know, it's not like we're all coming out and like, the stadium's being imploded and okay, and this new right. thing's going to be in its place. We all knew about it. We all knew it was going to happen. Maybe we didn't agree with it. Maybe we liked the state, right? It's not that, you know, like, because these things, you know, as fast as things are happening here, it is still like incremental, but like the infrastructure improvements to North 7th, that would make it truly like a pedestrian, cyclist friendly, like even for streamline in a place that has winters like we do, is a big expense and it's a big project. And I think it needs to happen to unlock these things, right? Like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But what we you know, can't have is this. We're going to do it, but P.S. Now things are less safe than they've ever been,
right.
Because we haven't made those like really necessary. You know, you go to places that have cold climate. You know, skywalks and buildings are connected. The way it just. Whole street, you know, the sidewalks are heated, all these different types of things that is required to, you know, bring these things to fruition and unlock that as opposed to just generating tension.
Yeah, concurrent updates. So you're going to build the Guthrie, make the street next to Whittier the safest street in Bozeman. If you're going to add potentially 250 cars, which is about the number of cars in a 14-block radius as it is right now, if you're going to add that many cars to one little corner of a residential neighborhood right next to an elementary school, which is a Title I, and I can go on about how I feel like that school is neglected in a lot of different ways over the years, but we're not going to go there. If we have the goodwill to say and to believe that development pays for infrastructure, then we have to be very clear about what is needed. And that would be one of those things where it's like that portion of Fifth Street is the absolute safest street, maybe in all of Montana, because there is nothing like the Guthrie anywhere. And I've looked all over the United States. There's nothing that matches that footprint without parking, without sophisticated transportation systems in a neighborhood. I mean, it is an anomaly as a result of, I think, sort of the Wild West lack of ordinances or lack of clarity of ordinances. And we're going to be a laughingstock because of it someday, I think. You know, people are going to come in and be like, oh, my God, you know. How did they let that happen?
Well, and that's a tough thing, too. You know, so like Midtown. So I served on the Urban Renewal Board when it still existed, and then they took it away. So, you know, Midtown is not against development, and we aren't against affordable housing. It's very difficult sometimes to be painted as a NIMBY when, you know, the people who are renting to others in our neighborhood, it's some of the most affordable rents in town, right?
Oh, yeah.
We have Darlington Manor. I can't even think of what – it's a high percentage of all the proposed new affordable units, things that are at like all the LIHTC projects, because of the way census tracts works and eligibility for that tax credit, Midtown is one of them. Yeah. And so that is why we are seeing so many of these like 60% AMI projects in the pipeline there.
550 within 4 square blocks of our homes.
Right. So never mind the fact that like – well, no, let's not say never mind. But – yes, there will be considerable infrastructure improvements that need to happen. We know right now, and this stuff's not even, I mean, some of the projects haven't broken ground yet. And what we're seeing on Peach Street traffic wise, what we're seeing on 7th, where that, and then the residential streets like North 5th, where the school is, right? The entrance is there, is now this throughway, right? Because to avoid the traffic going on there. So there's a lot in the pipeline that we're going to have to do some things about. So it's never been a question of like densification, if that's good. We're like, okay, right? You know, and even the parking thing too. It's like most of us have provided some of, you know, of our own off-street parking on our private property. Like that's, so we're not ultra reliant on the street parking.
Yeah.
That being said, it's a community asset. What are we doing with it, right? Like, are we unduly enriching someone else's bottom line or getting bailing them out from a poor, you know, land purchase decision, right? Like, with the school, I mean, I'm closer to the school than Noah is, but regularly, I mean, there's no street parking because it's teachers and parking, but like, they're educating our children.
Right.
Go ahead, park there. And if you can't find a spot, like park in my driveway. Right? You know what I mean? Like, thank you for doing this job that so many times is thankless, but is absolutely imperative for a healthy society. Right. You know, like when the Elm has a show, they have no parking. And then, you know, there's, you know, beer bottles and, you know, vomit in your front yard. It's like, oof. Yeah, no, I don't want to leverage this community asset in this way.
Right.
You know, like, what do we actually need? But somebody asked us that question, and it was like, it would be great to see the Guthrie be a senior, like a retirement community again, right? Like an assisted living facility again. Our community actually needs that. Yeah. It actually needs it.
Yeah, Gary DeLynn was the one who mentioned that. He said, well, you know, what irks me about this is that maybe Andy Halloran isn't responsible for closing two retirement homes, but he certainly is responsible for demolishing two. And now we just have one left.
Yeah.
So, like, another housing need, like, a need that we should build for.
Right, right.
Well,
it's some of these questions get, I think it gets more complicated. Like, the street parking thing, I've been involved in a lot of discussions about that in different...
I think a lot of people talk about parking in Bozeman.
Yeah.
I've read minutes from the 70s. Yeah, it's been going on a long time. Yeah.
You know, and there are some people that are just like, the street in front of my house is my street. And it's like, well, no. Mm-hmm. But I agree. It's like, okay, so we've got this public commodity. And so, it's for the public's use. But that means it's for the public's use all the way around. It's not yours because you live there. It's not the Guthrie's because they live there either, you know, and so it's, you know, those discussions get really complicated. and that's one of the things that struck me when I started reading about this and stuff. It's like, we also have a need for housing for workers. And it's hard to say that this hits that mark, obviously, but when I first was looking at it, it's like, I think it's closer than some other things. So it makes it complicated for me to try to sort out, you know, and I think when I was talking to Noah, I was kind of saying, you know, I've been watching the discussions online and stuff, and that's a stupid thing to do. And I understand that because you can't tell the difference between the vocal minority and vocal people who are part of the majority. And that's kind of a problem, right? It's like, so I don't really know what, you know, do, like you said, maybe that neighborhood is not opposed to maybe some infill, maybe some density. It's just this particular thing is too over the top and, you know, in a bunch of different aspects of it. And so, you know, it's a complicated discussion regardless. And I think one thing I think is that the way that we have discussions about these things is not very conducive to anyone understanding the intricacies of them, much less being able to bring forth ideas for, you know, maybe that someone might be able to take advantage of to make a project that could work. It just, you know, it seems like we too often devolve into just yelling. And like I said, maybe that's because I'm looking at the people that are doing the yelling and not the people that, like, you guys are like talking to your neighbors and going back and forth and talking to all of these people, going to all of these meetings and trying to understand what's going on. It just feels like, you know, it would be great if that was the thing that was had the high visibility instead of the things that seem like they currently have the high visibility, which are all of the kind of the maybe the more inflammatory and controversial viewpoints seem like the ones that always, and you know, that's our human nature.
Yeah, people like controversy.
Yeah, they like,
yeah,
they like
the loud. It calls your senses. I don't like, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say like I have some like magic idea of like poof affordability, you know, and I'll be frank. I'm irked in some ways, and I'm like, you know, the people who are on the hook right now for trying to solve an affordability crisis, things like a parking requirement did not cause an affordability crisis. This is a big, big issue.
Right.
Wealth inequality, like, you know, 70s onward, like economic mobility is vaporized, you know. And so this idea that like, oh, the free market will fix everything, right? You know, well, it's not.
Obviously, we've got a counterexample. Yeah.
And then you can't have it without subsidies. But it's like, okay, well, where are the subsidies coming from? What, a tax credit? Who's paying the most taxes in the country, right? You know what I mean? Right. Middle class, like as a percentage of their income, right? But then where does it go? Right? Like, okay, who owns this project, right? You know what I mean? Like, where did that money go? You know, and we do have developers in town, right? Like, there's a consortium and stuff of people who live here, who spent time here, who do their projects here, who factor in things like neighborhood impacts. And so it's not everybody, right? You know what I mean? It's like everyone's like, don't trust the developers. I was like, well, now wait a minute. Like, everything that you, every building that was developed by someone, right? So they're not all bad actors. The bad is what's really making things contentious for everyone. But but this affordability issue, this is so much bigger. And the best thing, I mean, the closest we can get at this point is at least trying to have a public equity stake in, you know, with the subsidies that we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Because what you said is like, you know, we have to depend on, you know, till somebody comes up with a project. And people forget that it is not that long ago that you didn't have to depend on a project to build a modest Sears home on a foundation, you know what I mean, that could survive on one income and you could have a couple kids, right? Like,
right.
That's not that long ago. And so now we're in this position where, like, if we don't, you know, get someone who's like able to get tax credits to make sure that they get an industry rate of return, like they're still gonna, that's their job, right?
Which
like
we
you
don't
know
get to see.
You know, like, well, that we can go down that rabbit hole another time, but you know, so the closest we can get, I think, is keeping the money in the community.
Mm-hmm.
Right, it's if our tax dollars are doing these things, whether it's in leveraging a public asset like parking or whatever that looks like, we got to keep it here.
Right.
You know, we're in the game.
Right, because these massive developments are kind of like Walmarts, essentially.
Well, they're
pulling wealth out of the community.
Right, extracting it.
And bringing it to Chicago and all those guys, right?
Well, like, there's no minimum income. You know, and that's – I love the idea of things being income responsive, not income restricted, because – right, so like – if you make a dollar more than whatever 80% is of the, sorry, you can't
move
be
out,
here anymore, right?
Exactly.
Like that's a bummer, right? Like that's not a good system. But there's nothing that says, so I go out and I want to get a mortgage, you know, because of what happened with subprime lending and everything, they'll run it and they'll say, you can't, or this is what you can afford, right? Our code does have a definition for affordable housing. It is that it housing that does not require any more than 30% of your income.
Right.
Affordable home is another definition in there. You say that is, you know, a project that is applied, you know, fits into the new ordinance, right?
Yeah.
But like we actually do define affordable housing as actually income responsive.
Yeah.
Right. So it's a very difficult thing to do. The closest we can get is to have an equity share. But how do we, you know?
Yeah, getting there seems like a steep hill to climb. So with the Guthrie, an issue is just the mass of it and how it fits in with the community. The weather, you know, seems like it's not really affordable. And the reason that matters maybe more so than other things is because it's going to take advantage of these affordability subsidies and benefits and stuff, and that's a thing that seems a little tough to swallow. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, and exactly, and you know, when talking about the Guthrie, it's clear that we're actually using the Guthrie to talk about the deep incentives.
Right.
And so the deep incentives have to be re-penciled. I mean, they have to be revisited. And one of my hopes is that the city commission will find sort of the humility to see that they made a error in approving this thing so quickly, because it serves essentially as an upzoning document, right? It upzones your neighborhood. It takes whatever's happening and it just, all of a sudden you're living in a different zone. And it did that without really any community engagement, virtually none, you know, and the community deserves more engagement with the city, because there's a lot of really amazing and intelligent people here, and there's a lot of amazing intelligent people in the city. And I think when there's sort of a coming together, you know, community, that these beautiful, you know, things happen through osmosis almost, or solutions and all of these things kind of come together in solutions and whatnot. And we could have potentially drafted a really effective ordinance in 2022. It's like, okay, like AMI is something that we evaluate yearly, January 1st. So if all of a sudden, you know, the income goes up $20,000, you know, we adjust it based on that. We drop it down to 60, or we drop it down to 50. So it's kind of a moving target. And we could have talked about community benefit, which is, I think, an incredible thing to talk about. It's like, if you're trading community benefits, then what are the community benefits? Is affordability the be all?
Right.
Or is climate change right on its heels? And you're like, oh, shoot, we should have probably made the Guthrie more energy efficient and LEED certified and less toxic for the people living there. We could have done it. But now that it's standing there, to do it now would be twice as expensive.
Right.
So we're like, we're only taking it one issue at a time. It's like putting the blinker on a car, like right before you need to turn, which is the culture, right. You know, by and large, right. In this country. You know, I'm from the Netherlands. I grew up between Bozeman and the Netherlands my whole life. And, you know, that juxtaposition has always showed me like extremely sophisticated culture where it feels kind of like claustrophobic and narrow, but it's brilliant. And like freedom and relaxation and there's just this kickback loving, I mean, the culture here is so much lighter, but there's a trade-off in each culture. And the trade-off here seems to be that we're not adding the sophisticated elements into our ordinances.
Yeah. I think that's all true. One thing that has occurred to me, you know, I've heard a lot of discussion, of, especially last year when the UDC thing blew up so spectacularly.
Kaboom.
And I have to, I had to shake my head because I saw a lot of commentary about a failure to get enough public input. And I'm like, I remember sitting in INC meetings for years, frankly, having them every meeting talk about how go talk to your neighbors. We're doing this UDC update and we need input, and they didn't get input, and they, you know, maybe the effectiveness of their outreach could have been better. But I think another thing that happened is people, you know, the other side of the equation has to get involved too, to make it balance out. And I think sometimes that was lacking, and people being people, until in things like this in particular, because there aren't a lot of people whose favorite thing to do at night is to go dig through issues like this, right? So until it actually blows up in your face, it's like in your neighborhood, it's a thing that's for a lot of people pretty hard to even think about. Yeah. And, you know, I think now, and maybe now's the time to come up with some more robust engagement, because I think maybe it's not in everybody's immediate neighborhood, but things have blown up in their town in spectacular fashion. So people are finally, they're kind of clued in. It's like, oh, I have to, maybe now's the time I have to maybe get a little bit more actively involved in this process. And since that, I think maybe that is a place where we're at, I hope that the city takes advantage of this point in time and they bring this something from their side to improve the engagement. And certainly there's been a lot of discussion about doing that and ways to do that. You know, how that will play out, I think, remains to be seen. And it could go nowhere, or maybe it could go in a lot of great directions. It, you know, I certainly hope that it will be the latter. But
yeah, stop noticing behind paywalls. That's a good start. You know, like if you need the Chronicle and you need to go all the way back to this old school classified section to figure out what's going on in your community.
Yeah.
Come on. And what about, you know, the internet? It's like, oh, well, why don't you just get on the, it's like, well, a lot of old ladies in our neighborhood don't even have computers.
Right.
So there's two paywalls right there. I think to some degree, when you have incredibly important issues, make it fun. Get people excited. Do it all in the month of January. I don't know. Like, like the thing is like build up to it. Like put a notice at the co-op, put a billboard up. Like, I don't know, throw a hot air balloon in the, you know, hot air balloon above that glows in the dark that says
that, vote. That thing that everybody's trying to figure out what's floating over the party. Like, what is that thing? Oh, it's a billboard to say, hey, go check this out.
Yeah, go check, you know, I mean, like, I mean, we're really getting to the point where it's like fixed mindsets versus growth mindsets. And we all kind of fluctuate between one or the other. But I think when it comes to this issue, it's we've been in this fixed mindset for a while because Bozeman was this way for a very long time. Right. And then it just went through an acceleration. But you're still running into people all the time that are like, oh, that's just not possible. And it's like, we're in America. Like, that's the American dream. It's like, you think it, you dream it, you build it, you do it. That's America. And like to see the same bureaucracy that you see in Europe where it's like, oh, no.
This is the way it's been for 300 years.
Yeah. And we're like, this is America. Like, no, like, you know, we can change this. And we do. We ultimately do, but we go through these horrendous, you know, moments, it feels like, where there's so much tension and animosity and here we are again, right?
Right.
I mean, I love the idea. Not everyone loves this idea, but, you know, we were talking about doing, like, trying to deploy a parking management tool in our neighborhood. Uh-huh. And, you know, we're looking at, you know, that it probably needs to happen adjacent to any commercial, you know, especially the B2M, the high redevelopment and everything. Because, yeah, it's like, okay, well, people aren't parking in the parking garage because the street parking in the neighborhood is free, but then the residents in the neighborhood. So it's like, okay, well, we're at that place now.
Should we do metered parking in our neighborhood and then we can keep the quarters?
So two things. I did confirm we don't have the meters from downtown anymore. Apparently they got rid of them, so we can't read. And two, there's some weird state law apparently that like downtown is grandfathered into about having paid parking, otherwise like we have to put it to the voters.
No,
which is, you know, the church anyway. But yeah, like what if we linked like your eligibility for a permit to like civic tasks, right?
There
like,
you go. Yeah.
It's like you know, okay, you know, so you signed up to shovel the snow for, you know, your aging neighbor, or you went to a city commission meeting, you know, and learned about something and then took it back to your neighborhood. And it's like, and if you don't do this, you can't get a parking permit.
Can you sell those credits?
This is America.
Exactly. We've got a whole new economy coming in.
I shoveled somebody's sidewalk in Milwaukee.
Boy, there was a lot of snow.
Because, yeah, it's not all one thing, right? Like, so there's a certain amount of apathy, right, that's happening. But then there's also this, you know, like, it is capacity. And that's something that Midtown, you know, when we served on the board or the Inc. together, like, that Midtown has struggled with, where it's like, so you, we want, you know, the onus of engagement needs to be on the city, like, and because asking people to come to a meeting in between two jobs,
right,
like, that's tough.
Yeah.
That's tough to do. And so, but does that apply to everyone in the community? Certainly it does not. But we have to be mindful of that.
Right, right.
That's accommodating
to a variety of people so that you don't unintentionally bias things extreme. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's pretty hard to avoid bias, but you can maybe at least avoid the obvious glaring ones.
I mean, that is a bigger question, too, of like, so it's very interesting that, like, if the neighborhood, like, just say, you know, around Whittier or, you know, if majority of the residents of any district did not come to the city and say, like, we want this to change. We want this to look this way. We want it to be different now. Who did?
Right.
Right, who did? And then on the flip side, too, if they have to come to me, like, guess what, everyone? If you don't increase your density by, like, +1 on every single one of your old lots, like, you know, there's going to be a special improvement district that's going to bankrupt all of you because your infrastructure is failing, right? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, like, to have that dialogue, too. But if the push for redevelopment is not coming from the people who live there, where is it coming from? And who is it serving? And then who is it benefiting?
Right.
Right.
So I have a few names to throw on that.
I mean, it's regrettably fairly obvious, and the answer is not great. I think, you know, so it's well, I want to thank you both very much for coming in and having this was a very robust discussion. It was fun for me. I have the luxury of looking at this particular issue mostly from the outside. I live over south of Kagi, and so things there aren't catching up to the problems that a lot of the other parts of the older parts of Bozeman are yet. So, you know, I look at these things and I, you know, maybe leap to some conclusions and stuff. So I very much value an opportunity to find out some more information. Just, I think things like this, just having discussions and maybe having a few different viewpoints and people that'll ask questions and stuff and people that have done the research and could provide answers. It's what we need a lot more of. So I want to thank you very much.
Well, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you. This was fun.
All right.